Thanks, Steve, for leading us. And I certainly found that period of silence really helpful. So I hope you did as well. And perhaps if there's something that God's saying to you in that, you don't need to listen to the rest of this. Just focus on what you've received in that time. We're going to be looking at this story. Perhaps I should start somewhere else. My name is Chris Reveley, a member of this church for a couple of years now. Just want to say thank you to all those who have been praying for Lucy and me during this week. Lucy's gone down to our daughter's for the next couple of days, and then her mum's funeral is on Thursday. And thank you very much. Many people have been kind and shared things and given us things, so thank you very much indeed for that. We've just read the passage of the Bible. When you heard it was a whole chapter, did you think, oh no, not have to listen to a whole chapter? And yet this is a fantastic James Bond-style thriller story. And it really is a brilliant story. And I have to say, I get really excited when I hear something like that. I also think, as we go through this, we should be saying to ourselves, well, we live in a world at the moment where that sort of thing's always happening. Think about what's going on in the Middle East at the moment. What does this sort of story say to us about that sort of situation today? And then also there's one other thing, if this works, let's just make sure it does. Yep. If you can read that one there. Being saved by a prostitute was not an easy story to share with their wives. That was the comment from some comedian, obviously, as the spies got back and had to explain exactly what had gone on. And actually, having the central story for a Sunday morning service, the central person being a prostitute, isn't that easy for a preacher either. It isn't quite what you expect in very nice middle-class Northwood. And I think God probably wants to say something to us about that as well. So, this is what we're going to have a look at. Very briefly, the story so far. Most of the time spent on the spy's story and Rahab's story. But I just want to mention Joshua's story and finish with God's story as we go through. So, surprise, surprise, today is about stories. It's about narratives. And I hope you can actually get beyond we've just heard a reading and think about what it must have felt like to be inside those situations, and we'll try and imagine that at different times. Now, I want to start with the story so far, and just to say that it's 40 years since I last preached in this church, and that was back in January, if you remember, and that was the time when Moses came down from the Mount Sinai. Well, 40 years has gone by, and in case you can't quite make out the map, there's a kind of arrow coming up the bottom on the right-hand side of the blue bit, which is the Dead Sea. And this is now the people of Israel coming to take their inheritance. And there's only about three people left now alive. Moses, who dies shortly after this bit. And then Joshua himself and Caleb, who were there 40 years ago for reasons that we've covered already. Anyway, just to be... What happens? They come to the first bit of where the Amorites are, and they offer actually a peace treaty to Sihon, king of the Amorites, and he says, no, thank you, and the Israelites wipe out Sihon and all his people. Then they go up, and the king of Bashan, Og, hears that they're coming, and he marches with an army, and they destroy that army. And if you were here last week, you will have heard the words when Chris shared with us about Joshua being told to be strong and courageous. And you'll remember, too, there was that funny bit about the tribes who wanted to stay on the east side of Jordan because they had big flocks. And Joshua says to them, you've got to come in and do the battle for the rest of the land as well. And they agreed. Well, the bit on the right-hand side of the River Jordan there, that's where, if you like, those tribes were going to live ultimately. So that's where we are. They're ready. They're sort of, I'll show you a map in a minute again, but the people of Israel are now ready to cross the Jordan, going into the west side of the country, and start the attack. And of course, as you know from reading, the first place they were coming to was Jericho. Now, that is not Jericho. That is Ho Chi Minh City, Vietnam. And it's an up-to-date picture, but I want to tell you a story. The only time I've ever been in anything resembling a spy situation, and it was very exciting. And I can share this now because I think it's far enough away, and I can't remember the names of any of the people involved, so I can't now compromise anyone by sharing this story. But in 1993, we were investigating with some other people the possibility of doing some Christian work actually in Ho Chi Minh City. 1993, it was still under the American embargo, very tight communist control. And we went in, and I went in with one Chinese man on this particular occasion, and we were going to meet up with some people who were in the underground church. And it was one of these stories where it was true, absolutely true, we were told to stand outside our hotel at a certain time, and two motorbikes would arrive. And sure enough, we stood there, and two very attractive ladies on motorbikes arrived and said, hop on the back. They gave me a crash helmet, which I thought was special attention to my safety being a Westerner, but it turned out I would stand out like a sore thumb with my beard and Western looks, and wearing a crash helmet covered me up a bit. That was the real reason. So we got on the back of these bikes, and we shot off very fast down a main road. And we were bombing along fast, and then suddenly did an incredibly sharp U-turn and went back down the other way. And I found out afterwards that was because they were concerned the secret police might well be following us, and therefore this was a perfectly sensible maneuver to do. Anyway, we then went off into some side streets, and the side streets got narrower and narrower, and there were still huge crowds everywhere. And then we were going really fast down a scary motorbike ride of my life, down this alleyway. I swear that I could have put my hands out and touched the buildings either side, except that I was gripping on for dear life, believe me. And we were heading straight down here, like here, through to where Howard's sitting at the back there, except that what was right in front was the grill in front of a shop front. And as we approached at, I suspect it was probably only 20 or 30 miles an hour, but felt like about 70, the grill went up. We shot into this small space and stopped very, very fast, because there was a brick wall after that, and the grill came straight down. And the two of us got off the bikes. I was definitely shaking. And we got off, and we were taken upstairs. We met two of the underground church leaders. They'd been just released from prison. They'd been in prison for a year without any trial or indeed any charge brought against them. And their only crime was that they were tremendous evangelists. And where have we got to? We got to an evangelism training centre. The floor above, there were lots of people making leather purses and leather bags. That was two reasons. One, because Christians couldn't get jobs, so that if you became a Christian, they had to employ you, and this was one way of earning some money. And secondly, because the floor above was where the evangelism training was going on. And so if they were raided, those people had bits of leather around as well, and they'd all immediately put their Bibles away and get their leather out to look like they were doing some leatherwork training as well. And those people were living in a context where actually they could not be honest to their state or honest in what they said in terms of the way they spoke about what they were doing. They had, for the sake of the gospel, which, by the way, was spreading like wildfire, they had to stand up in a special way. Boy, it was very exciting. Now, I share that. I'm going to come back in a minute on that. But I just wanted to put something about the fact that this story, although, of course, this is a story from the Bible ages ago, there are many Christians who are struggling with the issues about how you live in a context where, actually, it may not be quite straightforward, as we often preach on a Sunday morning, thou shalt not bear false witness, to work out what that means if the alternatives are as complicated as they might seem. So close your eyes for a second. Think back to the story now. You are two spies sent by Joshua, and you assume therefore by God, to go in and spy out Jericho. What would you have felt like, I wonder? So the two spies went from that place called Abel Shittim, which is about 13 miles, including crossing the Jordan at one of the fords, to Jericho, which you can just see as well. And they were told to go and spy out the land and see what it was like. So what happens? You imagine, they arrive. As they approach, they get lots of strange looks, because, of course, actually, everyone knew about this huge invading army that had just beaten the king of Og, the king of Bashan, and Sion, the other one, and they were across the Jordan. And Jericho is the first big city across the Jordan. So don't be surprised that they were very nervous. And suddenly, a couple of strangers wander into town. They began to feel very edgy, those spies, with people looking at them. And then suddenly, an extremely attractive and somewhat provocatively dressed woman comes up to them and says, "Do you fancy coming back to my place?" And in the context, that was something they said to, yes, absolutely. Probably they said to each other, okay, we'll explain to our wives later, but this gets us out of the position. So what do? Off the high street into some sort of dodgy backstreet brothel. But at least they were out of sight. Now, if you look at the Bible, we're not told what conversation then happened between then and dusk. Okay, the gates were obviously open when they came in. They're inside the brothel, and we don't know what was said. Though we can probably make some presumptions because of what Rahab said next in the story. But the secret police had also been tipped off that strangers had come into town, and someone must have reported that those people had gone to Rahab's brothel. And so what we find is that Rahab says, quick, I think we're about to get raided. You're going to have to hide. And apparently she had quite a large property, and she takes them up onto the roof of the property, and presumably by the sounds of it, she had big bales of flax, and she says, hide under there. At that moment, there's a knock on the door. She goes down. The secret police are there, sent by the king of Jericho. Bring out the men that came to see you. And she lies perfectly. She says, they did come here. Don't deny that. But they've gone. And they've headed out of town. I think you must have just missed them. So they rush out. They head out after where they assume they would go back towards the fords. They're chasing after them. And the gates are shut. So the men are still inside underneath the flax. And she goes up, and the spies now, who have been covered up, who know that they owe her their lives to her, and then she starts this amazing, amazing speech. She says, I know, this is verse 9, that the Lord has given this land to you, and that a great fear of you has fallen on us, so that all who live in this country are melting in fear because of you. We have heard how the Lord dried up the water of the Red Sea for you when you came out of Egypt. That was 40 years ago. And that message is still going around this area. And what you did to Sihon and Og, the two kings of the Amorites east of the Jordan, whom you completely destroyed. That was a lot more immediate. That was in the fairly near past. When we heard of it, our hearts sank and everyone's courage failed because of you. For the Lord your God is God in heaven above and on the earth below. That's what they heard. Now, what happens? The spies are desperate to get out of there. She starts to negotiate that she will be rescued, even though they know that the plans are for Joshua and the people to come in and to destroy Jericho. But they agree. She lets them down out of the house. Because she happens to have one room in the city walls, and they lower them down the side of the walls, because of course the gates are shut. And she says, don't go towards the fords of Jericho, get up into the hill country and stay there for a few days until the search has died down. And that's what they do. Eventually, they head back to Joshua. That's a picture of the Jordan. It isn't huge. It was in spate, but it isn't huge. And they basically go and they say to Joshua, it's unbelievable. The Lord has given the whole land into our hands. The people are terrified. And that's the message that comes back. Joshua's story. Why did he send the spies? When we look at the first time that spies went into the land, it's clear that God commanded Moses to send spies. We don't read it in this case. It just says at the beginning of chapter 2, then Joshua, son of Nun, secretly sent two spies from Shittim to go into the land. They were done in secret too. I don't suppose he even told the other elders or whatever, perhaps to protect them, or perhaps because of what happened last time spies went in and it all went wrong for 40 years. So what happens? Is it a lack of faith, do you think, on Joshua's part? God has said in chapter 1, I'm going to give you all the land. So why now does he send spies? Well, I think it's probably because he was a good military commander, and this was a sensible thing to do. And I think one of the things that often we can miss is this balance between faith and doing things really well, really professionally. And I think we should do both. I'm sure Joshua had faith, but I'm sure too he thought, what's the best thing to do as a military commander who's been commanded by God to lead this people? Send in spies, find out what the situation is. And that's what he does. And so his faith was reaffirmed when the spies come back that God was in control. But of course, one other bit of this story, if Joshua hadn't sent the spies, then Rahab would not have been saved. Rahab's story. I want you to put yourself for a moment into her shoes. What did she know? What did she think as she was walking the street that time and saw those two men? Just give yourself a moment to think about Rahab and what she knew about them and about what was going on around her. And let's think about Rahab. What do we know about her? There's almost certainly no doubt, even though some of the 19th century and early 20th century Bible commentators wanted to make her out to be an innkeeper, that she was anything other than a prostitute. Okay? But nevertheless, that's what it said. So here we've got someone who is clearly very serious, central to the story, who's a prostitute. She also is a fluent liar, because she lies brilliantly to the secret police. And she betrays her country. Now, if we hear a description of someone, don't think now that came out of the Bible, put that into the newspaper you read, and you read about someone of that sort, I wonder how you react. I wonder how you would typically respond to someone described in those terms. This is, after all, middle-class Northwood, isn't it? We don't particularly warm to those sorts of people described in that way. Well, first of all, I think one of the things we need to take into account is to actually ask in our hearts, if we hadn't heard that story out of the Bible, but we'd heard that story from someone who was a next-door neighbour of ours, how would we have reacted? And I think one of the things that struck me as I read this story, and I want to share with you, is to what extent are we very, very judgmental about things? Now, I would actually push this a bit harder, and I hope I don't cause any offence, but I understand that we should preach the whole truth of God from the front, and therefore it's important that we preach purity in sexual relationships and truth and so on. It's essential we do. But what we must be very careful not to do is turn that into condemnation of people, of individuals. Actually, if some people who were gay or lesbian or were sex workers, or whatever, started to come to this church, how comfortable would they actually feel, and how comfortable would we make them? But it isn't up to us anyway, is it? A different story in the Bible reminds us that man looks on the outward appearance, but God looks on the heart. And what was going on here, for someone whose lifestyle would not have fitted in well at the London School of Theology, was someone whose heart was right. Whose heart was so right that, as you will see in a moment, the impact she has goes right through the Bible and continues. So maybe just hold in your minds a second that thing. How quickly do we make judgments about people? And what's the implication of that to the way we behave towards them? And then how comfortable would people feel, perhaps, whose lifestyle wasn't maybe conveniently able to be as middle class and convenient as most of ours are, if they were in this church today? But of course we know the ending, and so the impact of this story can pass us by. Only a few months ago, in the preaching when we were going through the beginning of Matthew for the Christmas story, we read these words, didn't we? Salmon, the father of Boaz. Remember Boaz, whose mother was Ruth? Boaz, the father of Obed, whose mother... Got that twice, haven't I? We are. Obed, have I got it muddled? Got the wrong one there. Sorry about that. That should say, yeah, whose mother was Rahab. There we are. Sorry, I can't read it at the distance over there. whose mother was Rahab. So right in the story of the genealogy of King David and on to Jesus, we have the lying, treacherous sex worker whose heart was right before God. And she is in the genealogy. She is in the genealogy. But even more difficult, perhaps for us, is that there is one chapter in the whole of the New Testament that's known as the chapter on faith. The famous heroes of faith. Do you know who's there? Abraham's there. Do you know who's there? Moses is there. Do you know who's not there? Joshua is not there. But do you know who is there? The only woman held up as the ultimate example of faith, Rahab the prostitute. But if it's faith, well, at least we're not embarrassed by the fact it's her faith, but look at the terrible life she did, the way she lived. But unfortunately, the one book in the New Testament that throws in our face the fact you can't have just faith without sorting out your behaviour as well is the book of James. And there are two great examples of faith held up to us. Abraham and Rahab. Rahab, because of what she did. Because she didn't just believe in God, but she misled the secret police and helped the spies to escape. Her faith and her life were in parallel. Those three passages are all in the New Testament. They say that this story in Joshua 2 isn't just a one-off story, a bit of a blip, an inconvenience to our morality. But it's in your face that what matters is what is in our heart and the way that we behave to whatever God has revealed to us about himself. And that matters far more than morality or that many other things. Now, I'm not belittling morality. I'm just saying that the message from today isn't about that. It's about what matters first and foremost is what you believe and how when God reveals something to you, you take that and you act upon it. And it seems to me that we have to absolutely see that she is a really, really special example. She wasn't even remotely related to the right group of people. She didn't have the right morality. She probably didn't have the right theology. She certainly wasn't naturally in the space where she would worship the right God. But she becomes a hero in the lineage of Jesus. An example of someone who God revealed himself to, and she acted on that against all the evidence, against all the odds. So finally, God's story. Well, first of all, we've got this amazing providence of God because, you see, it was possible for her to be saved. She was in the wrong place. She was in the wrong city from a group of people who were destined to be destroyed. And yet, she says, "Give me a sure sign that you will spare the lives of my father and mother, my brothers and sisters and all who belong to them, and that you will save us from death." And of course, the sign was that she was to take the rope, the scarlet rope, and tie it in the window. That picture that said, "I'm acting out this faith. I'm going to be saved because I'm showing that symbol of what I have done." And God saved her. Did she know lots of stuff about following God? No. Did she have the right morality? No. But God saved her because she said, "I know that you are able to save us from death, God." She said too, "The Lord your God is God in heaven above and on the earth below." You see, she had more faith than many of the Israelites. Certainly than all the Israelites that had died in the wilderness who would not go in and take the land. Because she saw beyond racial differences and she saw that God was God of heaven and God of earth and that he was going to win. And of course, God's purposes. Because quite clearly, as the spies said, "The Lord has surely given the whole land into our hands." God's purposes were that the Israelites would cross the Jordan, would defeat Jericho, would move into the promised land, which had been promised to them when they left Egypt 40-something years before. And of course, God's purposes were not just at that one point, but they said as well that this person, this individual, Rahab, would be part of the family line that led through to the coming of the Lord Jesus. What's God's story in our world? I think back to my friends in Vietnam. And those people, I don't remember their names. The situation in Vietnam has changed quite a lot. It's still an oppressive regime, but it's changed quite a lot for Christians. And there are now semi-official Bible colleges in some parts of Vietnam. China has changed radically. Now, I say this because when I was growing up, when I was sort of in my teens and 20s, the exciting stories that people would have told in those circumstances would have been Brother Andrew getting Bibles into China. But can't we see that in God's purposes, perhaps Mao Zedong was the most effective evangelist that the world has ever seen? As a result of him, someone who was determined to stamp out Christianity, the Chinese church is booming and spreading. We pray for Wesley and Tintin as they head into Western China, which is still very, very much not touched by the gospel. But in many parts of Eastern and Central China now, the gospel is spreading fast. But nowadays, we probably look at the Muslim world and we'd say, how are God's purposes going to be worked out there? But right now, today, is more news. I put up this, obviously you recognise this. This is where there are different activities going on around the Middle East. I don't know what God is doing there. But what I do know is that just as God was going to give them the land of Israel in his purposes, God is going to work his purposes out. Do you remember the old hymn? God is working his purposes out as years succeed to years. God is working his purposes out and the time is drawing near. Nearer and nearer draws the time. The time that will surely be when the earth will be filled with the glory of God as the waters cover the sea. God is working his purposes out. Trust and pray that you will have the eyes to see what he is doing. But finally, God works his purposes out in each one of us as individuals. I put up a picture of a jigsaw because certainly at the moment in my family situation, it feels like there's a whole bunch of bits flying around, but I'm not quite sure how they're going to work out. But I have to hold on to the fact that I believe that God is God in heaven and God is God of the earth beneath. And I confess that. And I need to live and do what he puts in front of me as a result of the fact that following him comes with his Holy Spirit living within us to live out his purposes. And that's where I wanted to finish today. This story isn't an interesting thriller or a historical narrative from 3,000, 4,000 years ago. It's actually something which we can take today because God works his purposes out in ways we don't expect. But he wants us to say, whatever he's shown us of himself, we must live to that truth. And we must put it not just in faith, but in action every day as we live for him. Amen.